You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Ward County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400. Or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
Good morning, everybody. Good to be back at Radio Rehab, where we have an opportunity to share with the community substance abuse issues and mental health issues and how those issues affect us personally and affect the people we love, affect our community. And we try at Radio Rehab to bring guests that share their experience, strength, and hope about their recoveries and their struggles. And we try to bring guests to Radio Rehab that are also experts in the field and guests that are in the judicial system, the medical system, and just deal with folks that have substance abuse and mental health issues and how they can help us to help the people that we care about that we know are suffering with these kinds of issues. So that I have an incredible guest today that came on her time to share with us about her life, her story, what shaped her, what made her who she is. She is the Vandenberg Superior Court juvenile judge who helped Judge Niemeyer start a juvenile drug court in this community. We need it desperately. We need it in every community because there's so many kids getting in trouble and not doing the best they can do in school. And Judge Ferguson has been a real proactive force for change in our community for kids. And she was talking to me before the show, you know, that you don't just deal with the young person, you deal with their school. You deal with their parents, oftentimes their grandparents. You deal with their probation officers. You deal with their ministers. So she's got quite a job and takes it very seriously, knows for every kid she has to deal with a lot of people, not just the young person. So please stay tuned, hear her story. It's fascinating. And don't hesitate to call 424-1400, or if you're out of town, 888-846-7867. Nothing's below the belt. Please call, ask us questions. We care about what you want to know about. But I'm going to turn it over to her now. Let her tell us about herself, and we'll have a discussion here for the next hour. Thanks for tuning in. Good morning, Judge.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for taking the time. Wow.
It's my pleasure.
We're lucky to have you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Hope I can live up to the billing.
Definitely.
No, and this is a unique opportunity for me to be able to reach so many people
Yes. This
morning, and this is my first time on radio, so everybody please be gentle with me.
It's pretty easy.
Well, good. I'm glad. So, I've been the juvenile court, drug court judge for about 6 years now, and I always learn all the time. Never stop learning. It's a learning process. That's when I became a judge, was about 6 years ago. And I've had a varying path in my life and the way I've headed and the things I've done. And by the grace of God, I personally have never had an issue with addiction. And I just, or not for me personally as a person, but, and I just want to let people know that up front, because I think that sometimes people who do struggle with addictions think that if you haven't been addicted yourself, that you don't really bring anything to the table and you don't, really have anything to add. I get that from a lot of my kids, is they don't know, you don't know what I've been through.
You've not been there.
Exactly. And Lisa, I don't know the adults that you deal with, if you maybe find that sometimes.
It's a manipulation usually.
I think it is too. But, let's see. I started off in Illinois. It's where I was born. And I ended up moving with my family to California and grew up in Southern California as a child and into my early teens. And then my family relocated back to Illinois. And I was in Illinois as a high school student and in a rural community, very small. And not a lot to do, and I probably shouldn't be admitting this on
the
air, but I drank alcohol as a teenager. And I was one of the lucky ones in that it never had any effect on my life. I never had any involvement in law enforcement. My grades always stayed very good. It was social. It was on the weekends, not necessarily every weekend. And of course, back then, even, it was illegal, and I acknowledge that. And I did do something that I should not have done. But much like our society today, alcohol was very accepted back then.
And so available.
It's so available. And I think my parents probably had an idea, you know, because I know they admitted drinking as teenagers also. But again, they never had any problems, never had any negative consequences in their life, and that they had problems in school or anything like that. So it was kind of generational. It's like, well, I did it. She's doing it. She's not getting in any trouble. We'll kind of turn our head.
What years were you in high school?
The 80s? I was in the 70s.
In the 70s. Yeah, well, see, they didn't even have the drunk driving laws then.
No,
they were more worried about kids doing drugs than drinking alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah,
70s, that was the post-Vietnam, oh my God, no drugs. So I could see where you could easily get away with drinking. And
yeah, that was kind of the attitude. If you know, you're not smoking marijuana, you're not doing pills or you know, whatever else there was out there, that, you know, well, that's just what kids do.
Yeah.
Kind of mentality.
Sure.
Which, you know, sure, to an extent that's true. Kids are adventurous, they're going to experiment, and they're testing their wings and that kind of thing. But
was the drinking age 18 then too? Because it was, I graduated, it was 18 for beer and wine.
In Illinois, yes, exactly. In
Illinois, 21 for whiskey.
Yes, that's exactly what it was. I think in Illinois it was actually 19 for beer and wine.
Right.
And then it was 21 for hard liquor.
Wow. So alcohol, they didn't even think was a big deal at that point.
Yeah.
Now these poor kids can't go out without a couple drinks and get a minor consumption.
Exactly.
Ooh.
Yeah. It was a big non-secret, too. Wisconsin was 18 for everything.
Madison.
There was a lot of Illinois kids driving over the border to go get their alcohol and drink and stuff. So, yeah, alcohol, it was viewed very differently than it is now. And I don't think we fully understood how destructive it can be and how powerful it can be in your life. So, and then I went on to college after that, and then law school, and then eventually to be a judge. So,
was that your goal all along?
No, it wasn't. Neither was law school. My mom had decided I was going to be a doctor. I was going to be a surgeon, and that's the path I was set upon. And I always secretly wanted to be an attorney, but for whatever reason, I can't imagine. She did not hold attorneys in high esteem. So.
Really?
Yeah.
And she knew surgeons would make the big bucks,
exactly,
for sure.
Exactly. So it wasn't actually until I'd been in school for a while in undergraduate studies at Illinois State that I eventually switched my major and said, I'm going to do what I want to do and head off to law school.
No kidding.
That's what I did, yeah.
Were there very many girls in law school then?
Yeah, because I didn't go, like I said, my life has taken a varying path, and kind of a winding path. I went actually to law school as an adult. So I had a career as a computer consultant in between finishing my education and undergraduate education and going to law school. So, yeah.
So you really did know what you wanted.
Yeah. And that was always, it was always my goal for years. But by then I was married and, you know, is the timing right? And that's a big expenditure of money and a commitment and that type of thing. And you keep putting it off, waiting for the perfect time. And you realize that the perfect time's never going to come.
Yeah.
And I've just got to do it. And so that's what I did when I was 35 years old.
How awesome is that?
Yeah. I'm like, because I did not want to look back at my life having that huge regret that I didn't do that.
So for all our older adults, children, hey, it's never too late.
Never.
To get a career. And so was there just a sense of an honor for justice and the Constitution in you that drove you to law, you think? Or
yeah, very much so. That, you know, you have to remember primarily my background is, you know, rural Midwest, and, you know, I had family members through various generations that have served in the military, no one that served in law enforcement, but my family always had personally a great
communal.
They did, and just, you know, feeling a responsibility to give back to society, that type of thing, and to better society, and that's just, I sort of always grew up with that, and, you know, For some reason, I just, in my mind, thankfully, but however it turns out, I just always found myself on the side of law enforcement, on the side of the law kind of thing. And I was a deputy prosecutor before I was a judge. And
wow.
So, yeah, it's just a...
So the prosecutor mentality is different than the defense attorney mentality, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And when you become a judge, you have to meld both of those to be fair and not, and to look at people, you know, fairly and justly. And, you know, everybody, even judges, very much people and have their own leanings. And I know I've been told, and I fully admit, I'm probably more strict.
Mm-hmm. The prosecutorial mindset?
Yeah,
or
kind of. Yeah,
which is just take responsibility.
It is. That's exactly it. Take responsibility.
Yeah.
We all make mistakes. We all mess up to varying degrees. Just take responsibility for it.
See, in working with you in the drug court, when we were at Youth First working together on the Adventure-Based Challenge Program, you were the presiding judge of the kids we had in there that all had drug and alcohol problems.
Yeah.
I never saw you as rigid at all. I thought, yes, you hold them accountable. But you're fair with them, and you understand that it's all individualized. One size doesn't fit all.
Yeah, and I try to be.
See, that's
really
when I could see prosecutors being rigid, when they think everybody's stamped the same. They, you know, but I never saw you feeling that everybody was treated the same. You treated them all uniquely, I thought, but very responsible and accountable.
Yeah, I try to, and that is definitely one of my themes throughout, not only my professional life, but my private life with my own children is accountability, responsibility.
Right.
You know, I try and tell everybody, we're human, we are not perfect, we will never be perfect, that's just the nature of us. And we'll make mistakes, and that's understandable. It's what you do with those mistakes and afterwards.
Absolutely.
Learn from them, don't repeat them.
Yeah.
You know, make it part of a learning process and grow from them. And
so do prosecutors have a hard time understanding defense attorneys? Do sometimes prosecutors think they're just trying to justify the person's bad behavior? I mean, do you understand the other side of the law too, where...
I think just like you were talking about, how I think it varies from prosecutor to prosecutor and defense attorney to defense
attorney.
That's true. I think I try to, as a prosecutor, again, not to be just absolutely blind to the human condition.
Yeah.
Right before I became a judge, I was prosecuting domestic violence.
Ooh.
And so, you know, again...
That would be tough to...
That's one where I'll have to be honest with you, I didn't have a lot of sympathy towards the alleged abuser, or
right.
They were convicted, the abuser. But it's hard working with the victims too, because that's a whole psychology in and of itself of how people repeatedly put themselves in a victim situation. And it's not just women, it's
men. Do you think
too.
That's another addiction? Relationships? Codependency, to keep definitely going back and...
Definitely the codependency.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely the codependency.
That is so addictive.
Where your life rises and falls based on someone else.
You have no identity. It's all in them.
Exactly.
And they abuse you every chance they... Yeah, I don't get that either too well. But they deserve help too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Ooh.
And they were learning... patience is one of my short suits. I will admit I've been that way all my life, but... The victims of domestic violence and working with them really helped me learn patience, because, you know, very few of them get it the first time around, and sometimes they're calling for help the fourth, the fifth, the seventh, the tenth time. Mm-hmm. And you just have to be there for them. But finally, someday when they really get it, the help is there for them. And be patient with them. And it's hard.
It is. That's almost like alcoholism.
It really is.
Relapse. Yeah. So... Was there alcohol abuse tied into a lot of that domestic violence
Absolutely.
And drug abuse?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I would say, I've talked about this in the past, very much so. If I could wipe alcohol off the face of the earth, there would be so much less crime. I mean, really, I mean it.
That's
especially in my domestic violence cases, I would say probably easily 98% alcohol is involved. I mean, there sometimes would be other drugs involved, but really primarily alcohol.
I know, and you know what? There's only three or four DUI courts in the state because nobody wants to deal with the repeat drunk drivers because of the relapse rate, I guess, and because alcohol is legal. But alcohol causes more problems in our society than any other drug.
Yeah, it really does, just because it's so pervasive.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. And, you know, a lot of times I'd have victims telling me, you know, well, when they don't drink, they're a really great person. And, you know, you'd hear mm-hmm. that over and over again.
Sure.
And, you know, it's just really sad. And I think because probably my work with domestic violence and seeing all the alcohol involved in that, then when I became a juvenile court judge and had the opportunity to be involved with the drug court, it was kind of, in my mind, a really good progression for me because then I could work with young people who are maybe just developing problems or hadn't really begun that series of problems yet that we could try and educate. Mm-hmm.
Kind of part of your evolution in this thing, it looks like.
Yeah.
So back in the day when you were drinking, you just probably never even imagined. Do you think young people even have a clue how much problems alcohol create? You probably didn't see it creating a lot of problems in other, because you were functional.
Right. Yeah, very much so. My friends and I, we were very functional. And no, because this is another thing that I've had to learn. I've had to learn a lot of adolescent psychology,
mm-hmm.
child psychology.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a different brain, isn't it?
It's a very different brain.
Yeah.
It's very egocentric. It's just like all about them. And I was that way when I was a teenager, too. And you don't think beyond the next minute.
Right.
You don't think about the impact of my actions. It's just, is it fun? Am I going to have fun doing it right
mm-hmm.
now? Does it feel good kind of thing?
Yes.
And you don't think about, you know, driving drunk, what that could do. Or letting somebody drink too much. Are you maybe letting them become alcohol poisoned? Or, you know, you just don't think about those things because you're just in the moment.
It's the culture.
It's the
that
culture.
Young mind.
It's
in college,
moment.
Too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, when they're 40 and in our drug courts and still thinking like an 18-year-old, that's
that's
a lot where the growing up has to start. But you're right. As a teenager, it's almost part of their rite of passage.
It is, very much. Yeah, it's like, and I remember being this way, when you're a teenager, you're Teflon. Nothing will stick. You're invincible.
Right.
You'll get through it. You'll get past it.
Right.
No big deal. I'm a kid.
Right.
And I think a lot of kids, too, just in general towards juvenile justice, have the idea because they're a kid, they can't get in trouble for things.
When we first started the Mulberry Center Addiction Service Unit, Parkside, for kids, it was 1985, and nobody really believed adolescents could get addicted back then.
Yeah.
You know, there was that denial. They're just too young. They're just experimenting.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't think so.
No.
Experimenters kind of grow out of it.
Yeah.
These kids were getting in trouble in school, dropping out, fighting, in trouble with the law, in trouble at home.
Yeah, absolutely. We, you know, in talking about that, I was telling you earlier before our show started that working with these juveniles, these youths that are in my court, it's a learning process with them in that they're in drug court because they've had some negative consequence due to alcohol or drug use. But it's not until you work with them and they're with you a while and you're looking at the whole picture, you sort of then start seeing whether it's a substance abuse
mm-hmm.
problem they have or a delinquency
mm-hmm.
problem that they have.
I thought that was fascinating that you said that. That's true. You really have ongoing, your assessment of a kid never stops.
No, it really doesn't.
They look so different at different phases. That's true.
They do. They look different at different phases. And even though a lot of times it's their maybe substance abuse or alcohol use or whatever that gets them involved with the system, that isn't always necessarily the bottom line problem. Some participants that after they've been clean and sober for a good period of time, talking months,
mm-hmm.
they're still exhibiting very delinquent behavior.
Yeah.
And then you know it's probably really not substance abuse driven.
That was just the beginning.
Yeah, it's just a delinquent pattern of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where you have other kids that you thought maybe were more delinquent than substance abuse issues, and then you find out, no, they really do have a serious substance abuse issue.
And 90% of their life gets better if they don't use.
Yes. Yes.
Unreal.
Yeah.
So you became the judge for the juvenile drug court?
Yes.
Is that most what you do, or are there other things as a judge as well?
Oh, there's lots of other things. Yeah,
I know that's your love for sure.
Yeah, it is. In juvenile court, Judge Niemeyer and I, we handle juvenile delinquency cases, which is where I get the people from my drug court. But we also do children in need of services cases, CHINS cases, juvenile paternity cases, and then also probate court, which is estates, wills, adoptions, guardianships.
That's a lot on your plate.
Yeah, it keeps us out of trouble. It keeps us busy.
Wow. Well, the CHINS, is that mothers that lose their kids because the mothers are addicted or the fathers?
Yeah, sometimes. Most times. Yeah, it really.
And you have to supervise the kids or the parents?
No, Judge Niemeyer, actually, he has a CHINS parent drug court that he does. Mm-hmm. And that's where, when we have parents that their children have been found to be children in need of services, and it's maybe because of mother and father's bad substance abuse issues, then he has a drug court for them.
Yeah.
And through both of our drug courts, we'll have the participants be evaluated. If it's recommended that they have any therapy or treatment, we see that they get that. Then it's, you know, ongoing education, AA meetings, you know, testing clean and sober.
Mm-hmm.
But like with my drug court, and we try and tell the kids this, yes, being clean and sober is very important. We're a drug court. We're trying to be a holistic, take a holistic approach towards these people.
That's good.
And not, you know, just
compartmentalize the
exactly.
pot's your problem, or pills are your problem, or depression's your treating the whole deal.
We are. We want to know how they're interacting at school, what their grades are, how they do at home, who their peers are, who they're hanging out with.
And it's like parenting.
It is. Yeah, it's kind of a little bit of long-distance parenting.
Yeah.
And so we really depend on the parents a lot in the home, for my kids to really tell us what's going on in the home.
So you kind of have to assess the parents, too.
Well, you do. You do. We have a drug court advisory board, and before anyone is admitted to drug court, their probation officers submit materials on them, their history with the court, if there's been any psychological evaluations from the past, anything like that. And we as a board go through those packets and then discuss whether we think this child would be appropriate for our drug court, whether they would benefit from it. And their family background plays part into that, because we have got to have some family in place that will support these children in their effort to stay clean and sober.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, a lot of times we see families that are in as much trouble with their substance abuse issues as the kids are. And so they're not really going to be emotionally or physically available to help these kids out and keep them.
Then what do you do when you see the parents have a substance abuse issue too?
Well, is what we'll do, they're not really going to be appropriate for drug court at that point, because we feel like we're going to be setting them up to fail, because they're not going to be able to meet the standards of drug court and staying clean and sober. We will recommend maybe back to the probation officer, we really think this person needs treatment and they need to be put through a treatment program. Let's get them through that.
Yeah.
Leave them on your standard probation, and if they really continue to have problems, maybe we'll reevaluate them and look at them again. But it's really hard for kids to be in our drug court if they don't have that family support.
Do you ask the families, if they come in your drug court, to have chemically free homes?
Yes.
No booze in the house, pills locked up if parents are on meds. We do in our adult drug court, too. We ask them to get rid of everything.
Yes.
And I'm surprised at how some parents balk at that.
Absolutely, yes.
Why should I get rid of my alcohol? I'm not the one with the problem, you
know.
Exactly. Well, good, then get rid of it.
Yeah.
If you don't have a problem.
Right.
Right, right.
Yeah, I have.
You have that fight with the juveniles too, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, their parents are resistant sometimes.
Yeah.
I had, recently I had a new participant in my court, and she huffs air duster. The can, a lot of adults aren't familiar with the inhaling of these different chemicals from aerosol cans, but it's the duster that you used to clean off computer keyboards or something like that. And so I ordered that the parents have an aerosol-free household. I wanted them to take all aerosols out of their home And I even went as far, because she does huff, I'm worried that she might try and huff volatile chemicals like gasoline or paint. I had them remove all those things from their garage and anywhere they had them.
And they were probably willing to do that.
They were. They were kind of like, because I know it's a different way of looking at things.
The huffing.
A lot of parents.
Yeah, you don't hear about huffing too much anymore.
Don't. And it's so dangerous.
Yes.
It's
Is this a young kid?
Mid-teens.
Yeah.
Mid-teens.
So it's still going on too, the huffing.
Yeah. So, you know, we try and even there, you know, we're just get anything out of a house that could be inhaled that would be harmful to
anything
someone.
Tempting, yeah.
And, you know, and their parents were a little taken aback, I think, kind of like probably hadn't really thought about that. Mm-hmm. But they cooperated.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they want what's best for their child.
Plus, there's something about a nudge from the judge.
Yeah, yeah.
Look how much attention a judge can get in a person's life, really.
Yeah.
That's made the drug court so successful. I was shocked at the research saying one of the greatest factors to determine success in a drug court program is how well the judge interacts with the participant. Not us that deal with them day in and day out, the judge.
Yeah, I was shocked about that, too.
Wow.
I heard that at one of our trainings. And I was very shocked about that, because you're right, as a judge, I tended to look at it, well, you know, they're working with
their day reporting people.
Their day reporting people, their counselors,
yeah.
Their therapists, the AA groups they go to that are more daily in their lives. And I thought, what influence could I have over someone? I see them once a week if they're in phase one for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I really took for granted until I heard that, and have actually, they have scientific studies.
Yes.
You know, documented studies showing this. So, you know, it really made me be, I don't know, it just really made me take to heart.
I bet.
That
how much power you have in somebody's life, how much influence.
Influence, yeah, my role.
Yes.
Not to take it for granted.
So. Yes, somebody told me it's almost like, That's the healthy fear in the human, hopefully. The ones that aren't afraid of you are probably sociopaths, you know. But the ones that are, it's a healthy fear. It's like a respect, like, for God. This, you're like their higher power.
No.
I know you don't want it, but I mean, they really, there's that influence you have, that they really, they'll talk like trash to a lot of people, but not to the judge.
Yeah, generally that's true, yeah.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I've had
respect.
Drug court coordinator, you know, have some issues with the child before drug court. When they
the language.
Drug court, they're just, you know.
Yes, Your Honor. No,
very well.
Yeah. So you sometimes don't even see some of that other side of them.
No.
Because they are their best when they see you, that's for sure.
Generally, they are.
And that's good.
Yeah, it is. Sometimes we get a little crossways with each other in the courtroom, but... You know, I teach the kids that, you know, that's okay. It's you know, we can get upset with each other. I can become cross with them and, you know, let them have it and stuff, but we move on from there.
Yeah.
You know, I try and focus them and tell them what it's about and what I'm going to be about and speak real plainly with them. And I acknowledge it's hard what they're doing.
I think that's important too, don't you, with anybody on this journey of trying to stay sober. It really is a challenge in today's world to not use something.
It really is.
To take the edge off the day, you know?
Yeah, it really is. And I think, I don't know, it may sound kind of corny or maudlin or something, but it's just, I don't know, I really want these people to succeed because I really want them to have a good life and know what a good life they could have without the substances in their life. That, you know, and especially their kids, they have their whole life ahead of them.
Right. You really have a chance to make a difference at that age.
Yeah, and I want them to know how powerful they can be in their own lives and kind of empower them to make good choices, to take control of their lives.
And they listen to you when you tell them those words. Their parents could say it every day, their teachers, their schools. But when it comes from the judge, I think it has some sticking power.
I hope.
I hope so, too.
You know, that's it. I hope I'm just not another, you know,
authority figure. No.
Authority, adult.
I don't think so.
You know, has no clue what it's like to be a kid.
Don't you sometimes see them out and about, and they're like, Judge, how are you? Oh, thank you for being hard on me back and da-da-da-da.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes.
Definitely. Yeah, I know. Well, when we come back from break, I'm going to have to tell you what some of the kids used to say about you in ABC.
Okay.
But it was good.
Okay. Now that's all right. You can tell the bad, too. We'll have to be able to take criticism.
Well, that's true. That's true. Don't go away, Radio Rehab. We have to take a break and let some of our sponsors have some time here on the air. We will be right back with Judge Ferguson.
African Americans Yesterday and Today, sponsored by Zeta Zeta Omega Chapter of the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated.
And now, a moment in Black history.
Fannie L. Jackson Coppin was born in Washington, D.C. in 1835 and left an orphan at an early age. Her aunt bought her freedom for $125. Fannie worked for her schooling and went to Oberlin College in Ohio, where she graduated in 1865. She accepted a teacher position in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at the Institute for Colored Youth. In 1874, became principal and was outstanding as an educator until her death, January 21, 1913. Mrs. Coppin was active as organizer and lecturer in the Black women's rights movements.
Experts and stuff. Experts and stuff. Experts and stuff. You won't get enough. Experts and stuff. Experts and stuff. Experts and stuff. Never get enough. Experts and stuff. It's a place to be. Baked potatoes for you and me. Free delivery catering. Experts and stuff will make you want to see.
Yeah, you're listening to the radio. It's me again. Have you got that HIV test yet? As I mentioned before, if you have put yourself at risk by having unprotected sex with more than one person or used IV drugs, guess what? You've put yourself at risk for HIV. Make that appointment today by calling the Vandenberg County Health Department at 435-5683 or stop by 420 East Mulberry. It's that easy. Remember, everything is confidential. No one has to know you've gotten the test unless you tell them, so do it. What do you have to lose except maybe your life or your partner's life? When in doubt, get checked out.
You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Warwick County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400, or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
Well, we're back, and I've been talking to Judge Ferguson again just about kids and about our community and young adults, college culture as well, where alcohol and drugs seem to be very prevalent, and the difference between some young people that can drink and remain pretty functional, like Judge Ferguson did, never got in any trouble, kept her grades up, went on to college, as opposed to other young people that, my God, the first time they start drinking, they're in legal trouble or drugs, etc. So anyway, I was just asking her if she saw a difference or if she had to wear different hats with young people in the minority communities or minority families. So we were talking about that because we are learning that we have to individualize the treatment. So I was just curious and wanted to share with you if she thinks there's some difference as a judge when you see kids from different cultures and different sides of the community, how you treat that.
Back again to you, you want to treat everyone as an individual, but, you know, you learn to look for, patterns and that type of thing to kind of help you along. And one thing that you and I have talked about that you see in adults as we see well in kids, that marijuana seems to be really, it crosses all
socioeconomic,
ethnic,
religious,
everywhere. Yeah, and then there's some drugs that, for whatever reason, you seem to see a little bit more in one community or another, you know, you may see more cocaine in one community, you may see more methamphetamine in another community. Mm-hmm. And thank heavens, in our juveniles, you know, we're not seeing a lot of the methamphetamine, the cocaine. With the juveniles, it still tends to be primarily alcohol, marijuana, pills.
Hmm. Yeah, they're coming in,
pills,
aren't they?
Yeah, pills are coming in more because...
Is that cultural?
At school, no.
That's across us all?
Yeah. Yep. They, you know, you don't hear about them so much anymore, but kids would steal prescription drugs from adults in their household and take them to school and sell them. And it's really dangerous because kids don't know what those pills do.
Yeah.
And it's just, they're called farming parties, PH.
ARM, the farm party.
Yeah,
they're big in the colleges, the farm parties. They're in the high schools now, too?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
They are. And they'll just have a big bag of pills, just a mixed bag of pills, and you pay so much, you pull out so many pills and take them.
Unbelievable.
It's anything from blood pressure medicine to narcotic painkillers, and it's just scary because these kids are mixing.
They're stoned anyway. When they go to these parties, they're smoking pot or drinking. They're not in their right mind when they're grabbing into that bag anyway.
It's bad. It's scary.
So in your drug court, or just as a judge, in your philosophy, 100% abstinence has to be the goal no matter what culture or community you live in, right?
Absolutely.
Which means pot, pills, powders, alcohol.
Alcohol, anything like that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So
it just does.
How do you deal with, you know, like if a kid relapses, if they come into you because of cocaine issues, but then they are positive for marijuana, or they come into you from drinking issues and then they're positive for pills?
Well, it's kind of a positive is a positive regardless of what it's for, and we try to get to the source of what caused the relapse. I mean, we understand that there are going to be relapses. You hope not, but again, the human person's not perfect. So, you know, you try and just isolate what happened. What did you do? How much did you do? Where did you get it? What were the circumstances behind it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, were you feeling bad about something? Did you get back in with a peer group? That's a big thing with the kids.
It is,
I don't know if it is so much with adults. I don't know that it is, but kids, there's so much about their peer groups.
And they can't
so
avoid
much
it.
Their identity.
Yeah, we adults can avoid it. We don't have to go in a bar.
Exactly.
When they go to a party or even to school, they know where to get hooked up.
Yeah, exactly. And I tell the kids the hardest thing probably I will ask them to do, even above and beyond staying clean and sober, is to change your peer group.
Oh, that's
and
so hard.
And I'll ask
hard.
Them, I said, think about what, I go, what your friends that you used to hang out with before you came to this court, what did you guys do? What did you do to kick it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're like, oh, drink or smoke weed or, you know, whatever. And I said, if you go back to that group, that is what you will end up doing again. I go, people hang together for a reason, and it's generally because they like doing the same things.
Sure.
And that's why you hung with those people.
Yeah.
Not because you enjoyed going to movies with them or going to play baseball with or whatever.
Yeah.
It's because you guys got drunk, you got high, whatever.
Yeah.
I said you cannot hang around those people and remain clean and sober.
But if they have that wild, crazy personality temperament, they've got to find other wild, crazy people to be happy. And the rooms of AA and NA are full of those kinds of folks that have that rebellious, you know, personality, sensation-seeking personality. But the young people, I think, feel lost in the 12-step meetings, the college age, the adolescent. They feel like it's for old people still. There's that stigma.
They do. They do. And the adults there are talking about adult problems, lost jobs or shattered families or that kind of thing. And they feel that it's issues that don't really pertain.
And they're right.
And they are.
But they have the same illness to treat,
they
for sure.
They have the same illness, and we try and tell them, unless we get this under control now, that will be you in 10 years. That will be you in 20 years with the shattered family, the lost jobs, the incarceration. You know, and so even though it's maybe not your life and what's going on in your life right now, that will be you.
Yes.
Serious changes are made in your life. And, you know, our philosophy is with the teens and, you know, anybody who's a recovering addict, it's an ongoing, everyday process.
It really is.
You don't get it the first time or the second time or the tenth time, but you will hopefully eventually get it. And we're kind of looking at planting seeds.
I think that's a good way to look at it.
That maybe even if they don't get it this time around, that, you know, mm-hmm. in the future, they'll think back, oh, I remember I learned this, or oh, I remember back to that mm-hmm. 6 months or a year when I was sober.
And they do come back. I see a lot of kids in AA that were once in your program and later had to go back and try some research.
Absolutely.
But later come back in ready to surrender.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does it get frustrating to you, Judge, sometimes that you can't reason with that kind of brain like you can? It's like my judge wants to say, you're going to get incarcerated for 20 years if you pick up another drink or drug. And he wants to believe this is really going to get their attention, to think of that long-term incarceration. But it doesn't.
It doesn't.
That doesn't get their attention.
It doesn't get their attention.
Is that frustrating as a judge or...
No, even though I don't have the disease myself, I've tried to kind of empathize and realize, you know, what people are going through. And I realize it's just the disease takes over. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter what the consequences are.
No, that's
I mean, if consequences mattered,
we wouldn't be here. Yeah.
People would be able to curb their behavior.
Yeah.
And it's just that disease progress. And some people, the disease doesn't get as far in them and doesn't destroy their life as much.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, and it's just,
Do you see with some of the young people, not even what community or culture, but that they are so functional. They're still getting good grades. Their family's intact. And then they come to you with drug problems and they think, well, I'm not as bad as so-and-so.
Yes. Yes.
And you have to say, hey, you got the same
exactly.
illness they have.
Yeah.
Diabetics aren't it different and different. Yeah.
Yeah, and you tend to have that more kids with alcohol and stuff. Well, it's just alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, yeah, you've had a DUI.
Maybe two of them.
You got kicked out of school, you know, for being drunk at school. Your grades stink, you know, whatever. And, you know mom and dad drink in the home. And that's another thing, too, is they're adults. You're not. They're over 21. You're not.
Yeah.
Thing. Kids are just like, well, they do it. Why can't I?
So black and white.
It is. And something that scares me, too, that it's hard to talk with kids about, make them understand, is that you hear these ideas about marijuana coming out of, I don't mean to pick on California, I used to live there when I was a kid, but the legalized marijuana, the medicinal marijuana, and you know, you're trying to tell a child in court how marijuana can do such bad things to them and devastate their life, yet all over the media, we're hearing about the lawmakers in California wanting to make marijuana perfectly legal and accessible to anyone.
And it's such double messages.
It is. It's, you know, it's got to be horribly confusing for these children.
Last week, and this has been a hot topic, especially in the black community, recently in Vandenberg County, a high-profile university employee was caught with thousands of dollars of marijuana and got 6 months probation.
Yeah.
Where others are caught with much, much less and are doing time.
Yeah.
There is that disparity, and young people see it. Older people see it.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't mean it's a reason to justify your inappropriate illegal behavior, but you're right. They look and say, well, it's legal somewhere else, or that guy got off with $40,000. And they're like, what's wrong with me? What's wrong? Yeah. Why are you picking on me?
Yeah.
Do you get a lot of that?
Not so much, but I can see how that's out there for them to pick up on.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's not consistent at all. And that's hard.
It is.
It's really hard to make kids understand. Kids
yeah.
don't have, you know, I try and tell my own kids this. You may be very intelligent, but you're not wise. Wisdom is something that comes with age, that comes with living and learning. Do you gain wisdom? And, you know, they, you know, think they're smart and they can make good arguments and they can, but it's not until you live life that you really gain that wisdom and are able to discern and understand.
That's a neat way to put the difference between intelligence and wisdom. And you speak so passionately about your two kids and your husband.
Yeah, they're everything.
So are they at risk too?
Yeah. I would say not so much my husband because... You know, he's...
No, your kids.
Your
kids.
I would say, you know, he has his identity of who he is and the choices he's made in his life.
He's pretty set.
Yeah, he's set. But, my kids definitely are. You know, it's just, it's the nature of all of us when we're that age. We're trying to define our identity and who we are as a person mm-hmm. and what our values are. And we all know just because your parents say it or your teachers say it doesn't mean you're going to necessarily internalize it and believe it.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I talk to my children
Do you?
About drugs. Absolutely. They know what I do.
And they know how you feel about
it. They know how I feel about it.
Drugs.
They know what I do. You know, I'm honest, especially with my daughter. She's 15. You know, I'm honest with her about, you know, I drank in high school. I mean, she knows that. And you know, that didn't make it right. And, you know, I try it. And again, it sounds like a double standard. Kids look at their parents and it's like, you know, it's the old adage, do as I say and not as I do.
But it is different
not
now.
Not as I did, but it is different.
It now. Is. Their brains are different
yeah.
now. There's proof of that.
They really are.
What and they have come, especially girls. They have a lot
right.
of decisions to make in a day. Boys yeah. do too, but the girls, ooh, one drink, they could make some serious bad decisions.
That, yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah, no, my kids, I'm very honest with them. And like I said, they're very well aware of what I do and what my beliefs are.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I really try and educate them so they can make good choices.
Do you think, taking your judge hat off now, putting your mom hat on, do you think it is important that mothers and fathers have those discussions with their kids? And do you think even parents that do drink need to continue having the discussions about alcohol and drug abuse and teenagers?
Yeah, I'm a very, very big proponent of that.
Communication.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What if the parent drinks? It's, well, do you just say it's illegal, though, if you're under 21? I mean, that seems so lame. But
it does seem lame, but it's true. It's the,
yeah.
You know, it's just the way it is. And for some reason, our society has determined that at the age of 21, you are able to handle the responsibility of alcohol.
But you can go to war at 18.
Yeah, exactly. You can vote at 18
yeah.
for our country.
Yeah.
That's
it's just the way it is. Yeah.
There. But no, I think, you know, I think parents should share with their children their ideas on alcohol and their experiences with it. And, yeah, I don't know. I'm a big believer in communication.
Mm-hmm. And it's got to start before high school.
It does. It really does. And educating children as to the dangers and
yeah.
and so they can be on guard and watch out. And
so do you have parents come to you with a lot of guilt? Like, Judge, I drink. I've enjoyed alcohol my life. It hasn't made my life. I'm functional. Did my drinking have anything to do with my kids' bad choices? A lot of guilt these parents, and it's not about the parents drinking that
yeah.
necessarily. That peer pressure is strong out there.
It is strong. You know, I have had in court some parents express to me, you know, I wish I would have done things differently, or, you know, I don't know how much of my decisions contributed to my child being here. And so, yeah, you do see with some of those parents that they
guilt.
Very much carry that guilt
mm-hmm.
and are really concerned and thoughtful about maybe their actions contributing to their child being there.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, unfortunately, too, we see a lot of family members that are having their own issues.
With substance abuse or,
yeah.
or other
life
issues.
Yeah.
And so you get a chance to confront them, too, as a parent?
Sometimes I really just try and focus on my kids.
Yeah.
In court. See, the only time I deal with the children is in court. Because, you know, we have a therapist, a drug court coordinator to deal with the families
mm-hmm.
Outside of the courtroom. So I'm dealing with them, you know, in the courtroom setting. But if I feel that a parent is doing something to contribute directly to this child not making good decisions, or if the child relapsed or if the child did something against the rules, I absolutely will discuss that with the parent in court.
Yeah.
And I've been known to verbally beat up on a few parents.
Well, I know when I came to visit your court one time, you got on a parent for not getting their kids to meetings
yeah.
where they had transportation, they had a car, and they worked and were able to get everywhere else, but came up with the excuse for some reason they couldn't get their kid to the required 12-step meeting. I remember you saying, look, this is your responsibility. This kid's yours till they're 99, so.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's it. You've got to be there to support that child in that you provide for them what they need to be a healthy person.
To get well, yeah.
To get well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know it's frustrating for some of these parents because they've lived with these kids day in, day out.
They're tired of the phone calls.
They are. They're tired of the child's bad behavior.
Right.
But, you know, we've got the child in a situation now where we're trying to get them turned around or teach mm-hmm. them better behaviors and decision making. So I've got to have the parents on board with that.
And sometimes you have to kick their butt.
You do.
For sure.
And unfortunately, I'm kind of known for verbally kicking people's
the kick butt.
So,
the kick butt. But you know, well, like you said, you're not, yeah, the kid is your responsibility in the system, but you're dealing with all the other, the parents, the teachers, the probation, the therapists. Wow. With a kid, you have so many other people to deal with. In our adult drug court, we just have the adult.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. You know, you can, the adult's the kid, just so responsible for themselves.
Yeah.
But with the kid, that's it. You know, they're, like you said, they're interacting with teachers, therapists, mm-hmm. parents. And a lot of the kids don't have the ability to drive. They don't have driver's license, so they're not old enough. So you've got to depend on parents or family members. Or we try and help them with public transportation, with bus tokens if we can. But, you know, sometimes, yeah, it's like these parents have really got to step up and help out. And
yeah.
I know they're probably burned out and worn out and everything else with this child, but I'm sorry, it's your child. And you've got
right.
to still be responsible for them and raise
yes.
them. Yeah. The courts can't do it all.
No, no. Well, we've got a few minutes left. I'd like you, if you would, just tell us a little about what your vision is, where what things you love best about what you've done so far, which has been incredibly good stuff for our young people. I was going to tell you, the kids in ABC at Youth First always say they know exactly what you're going to say when they come in front of you. When Judge hears this, I know exactly what she's going to do. And we always say to them, what a gift for those kids to know exactly what you're going to say, exactly what your beliefs are, exactly what to expect from you, because there's not many adults in their life they know what to expect. They know what you're going to say. It's consistent. They know what your beliefs are. And we always say to them, thank God you have an adult in your life and your team that they know exactly how you're going to react when they come and tell you they slipped, or when they come and tell you they played hooky from school. Or they know exactly how you're going to react. And I think that's a lot of what kids need to know, how adults really do feel and what we're going to do, what the consequences will be ahead of time. So anyway, that I just had to throw that. But where do you see, where would you like to go? Do you see this as something you want to continue doing, working with juveniles and their families and in this way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love doing it. I've been doing it for years now. I'm not tired of doing it. I still have energy and drive mm-hmm. for it. Yeah, because, you know, I feel like a lot of children, you know, the circumstances of their life are beyond their control. And I want to teach them, you know, if we can, and it's not me, I say I want to, it's not me, it's also everyone that works for them, with
yeah.
them, our drug court team, especially the drug court coordinator, you know, working with them. We want to give them a chance to have a good life and to make good decisions and mm-hmm. to exceed their own expectations. I mean, one of the things, I think a lot of the times we tend to put people, to pigeonhole people and only have certain expectations of them, or only not have any expectations depending on their family or their backgrounds or whatever. And that's always one of the things I loved about your program at ABC, is that you would have these children doing things that they never dreamed of doing. Things like rappelling or bungee
climbing
jumping,
that wall,
climbing,
yes,
you know?
Hiking.
And to maybe a lot of people that doesn't sound like any big deal, but these are kids that by and large have lived in the city here in Evansville and never have gotten outside into the outdoors to do these kinds of things.
Yeah, nothing cultural.
And you know, nothing beyond just what they do in their everyday life.
Like survival.
Yeah.
They're in survival every day.
These kids come back and their eyes are big and they're bright and they're smiling and they're like, I never thought I could do that. And
I know,
gosh, I was doing this and I was doing that. And you can
see
you have stretched their boundary for them. You have stretched them as a person to show them you can do things you never thought about doing.
And they never forget it.
You're capable of so much more. And, you
that's
know,
true.
That's what you have been giving people, not only your adults, but the juveniles, the youths through ABC. And That's what I hope we
love
can do
those
for
kids.
Them at the drug court. Yeah, it's just like teaching.
Well, it's
them.
That partnership.
You're so much more.
Yeah, you're so much better than the choices you make.
Absolutely.
I think of one kid, Ryan. Oh, my God, a thug. Nobody wanted to deal with him, and he ended up being the leader of our group. So he's a kid that kids listen to if he could turn it around.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I mean, his goal was just to not say the F word a day at a time, along with don't drink, don't drug.
Exactly.
And he did it. He turned into a little gentleman.
Yeah. They're
unbelievable.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
Kids amaze themselves.
So you get to really watch the diamond in the rough.
Yes, absolutely.
And I know you really expect to see the diamond in the rough.
We do.
I can tell you do.
We do.
Yeah.
And, you know, we as a team, we understand we may not, that diamond may stay really rough for the next few years and tumble around, but we're hoping eventually, you know, between all the work that we do. And I know some of our kids end up in the adult drug courts, and we try and keep track of them and kind of know what's going on with them beyond us. And you know, it's just like if you help a kid here or there, if you make their life a little bit better, if you help them make better choices to not hurt themselves.
Yes.
Or to stay out of prison or to not get behind a wheel and drive drunk and hurt somebody, then we've been very successful.
Mm-hmm. And then you're back to doing what you said you got into law to do to begin with, which make the community a better place.
Absolutely. Yeah, because when we intervene in these kids' life and help them to be a better person, we help our community be a better place, too.
I think so.
And then those kids can go on and enrich the community in their own unique way. And I really, truly believe that. I am the eternal optimist.
You are. And Judge Kane, it shows in your courtroom.
Oh, I hope
so. And I'm
so.
Sure it shows in your family. I bet they're all very proud of the mother they have and the wife they have, that you're making a difference and bringing people in to help with it.
It
takes the village.
It does. It takes all of us in our own unique roles. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could not do this without all the people out there, so, and everyone's cooperation, and so absolutely takes all of us.
Is it open for the public to come and see your drug court process, or
no,
is it closed because juvenile?
Because it's juvenile, it's closed. And we don't even let, sometimes the kids want to bring their friends along or whatever, we don't even allow them in. It's just family members and the kids. Yeah.
But if anybody has questions, comments, concerns, you all could write to radiorehab@yahoo.com, and we can get those questions to Judge Ferguson.
Absolutely.
And you would be able to answer those for sure.
I would love to.
So any parents in the community or aunties or grandparents, anybody that has questions or thinks the judge should know something.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Let us know at radiorehab@yahoo.com.
Yeah, we're always there to try and help people, absolutely.
And are you available to go talk as well to other community? I know you're pretty busy, but...
Yeah, in the evenings, definitely. The daytime's pretty full, but yeah, absolutely, I would love to. Anything I can do to help people.
Well, thank you.
And help people live a better life.
We need to hear more from you. I think, especially since I've been doing radio rehab and in the community here, there is such a sense that the judges and prosecutors and attorneys are so far away from the community and the person in the community, and it's nice to have you here to bring you closer to it.
Well, good, and I'm happy to be here and in a different role than most people are used to seeing me in.
Yes.
Approachable. I try to be approachable no matter what, but it's hard when you're in a courtroom, but
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're all in this together.
We are.
Too.
Yes.
So absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for
coming.
Thank
you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Oh, I just love coming and watching you in court and you as a person. You walk the walk. You talk the talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Radio Rehab, please don't hesitate to write us any questions, make any comments. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to hear Judge Ferguson on the World Wide Web, you can go to www.lisaseifcares.net, and her interview will be on there in the middle of next week. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, everybody we smile at and care about, it does make a difference. As the judge said today, we might just be planting seeds. Maybe we're all farmers and hoping someday they will sprout. So never give up. And don't forget, between now and next week, to do the next right thing.